Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time of day you are listening. This is Ben Goujon with Quad City Arts, and welcome back to Talking Art, brought to you by Quad City Bank and Trust. Today, after what seems like an eternity and still kind of boggles my mind that we've not talked yet, I'm talking art with filmmaker Kelly Rundle of Fourth Wall Films, who honestly has so many projects going on that I don't really even know where to start. Kelly, welcome to Talking Art.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah. I've been here 7 years, and I've known about you and Fourth Wall Films the whole time, and yet we've never actually had a chance to intersect. So I'm so glad we get to sit down and get to know you and know all about the work today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah. So let's start with, let's start just with who you are and who Fourth Wall Films is and what you do for any of our viewers who don't know.
I'm a filmmaker, a full-time one. So Tammy and I are my wife work together. We're both full-time filmmakers, so we're kind of a rare breed.
Yeah, it's so impressive to me, coming out of a larger market to the Quad Cities, and we are a larger metro area, but being able to meet the people who are able to support themselves full-time through their art and through doing what they love. And so with Fourth Wall Films, you focus primarily on documentaries, right?
We do. And we got started on that early on. Mm-hmm. So Tammy and I lived in Los Angeles for 18 years, and I had the idea that I wanted to have a go at the film industry.
Sure.
Until I got there. but it was a great experience. And I worked for Sony Pictures for 7 years. And started out in the mailroom and then was in international distribution for most of that time.
Oh, wow.
Marketing and distribution.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about the business.
Yeah.
And also was walking around the studio a lot every day and just seeing the movie industry at work, which was, for a kid from the Midwest, was really a treat. That never got old.
Yeah. Well, and that's, that's so fascinating. And I have dabbled in film, and mostly just as an actor, but that business side of it is a complete mystery to me, And with my theater background, I'm like, I know how to make money doing theater. Like, you put on the show, you sell tickets, you get spot. With film, that back end, the distribution, and how you get money coming in, I just don't even know where to start with it.
and it's different, of course, for the folks working at that level. It's
sure.
Very, very different.
Yeah.
But essentially, as a small company, we look and see what the bigger folks are doing, because chances are they're doing the right things to make money. That's what Hollywood's good at, is making money.
Right.
So it doesn't work quite that way, of course, because we're not, we're choosing non-commercial type topics and things that are being overlooked by others, especially just Midwestern stories in general is where we ended up focusing. But it was about 3 or 4 years into my time at Sony Pictures when I realized, well, there's only 2 or 3 movies a year that I'm really sort of proud that I have some remote hand in, in some way. And so we'd started talking about producing something independently.
Yeah.
And then over a 10-year period, because we were working full-time, we made our first feature-length documentary, which we shot on 16-millimeter film.
Oh, wow. That's
so
cool.
Yeah, we were pretty crazy. But that film was very successful, and it was in theaters in the Midwest for about 14 months.
Wow.
And it made everything that followed possible.
Right.
Because it was well-received.
Well, and how did you decide to kind of focus on documentaries?
That is a great question. When we decided we were going to produce something independently, we developed 3 different kind of topics, but they were all documentaries.
Yeah.
Now, we were members of the International Documentary Association pretty early on, too, and so every year we would go to an event called DocuDay. And that was an event the Saturday before the Oscars. And we would go to the Writers Guild Theater and watch all of the Academy-nominated documentary features and shorts.
Oh, fun.
That's five features, five shorts. Mm-hmm. And the filmmakers are almost always there because the awards are going to be passed out the next day.
Yeah.
So it was like a full day, like a seminar.
Yeah.
You were just, you know, drained by the time it was over, but exhilarated.
Yeah.
So we had exposure to that world that way. And so we shot that film with a theatrical release in mind, and then financially couldn't finish it as a film because it's the post-production end of film is very, very expensive.
Yeah.
And so it lingered for a year or two, and then we kept working on it, and then suddenly digital editing was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, well, we're giving up a theatrical release, but we want to finish the film, and we did that. And then we ended up having a theatrical release anyway. So it all worked out.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that. But also, you know, you bring up such a good point, I think, that is so challenging for young filmmakers or anyone breaking into the industry is there's so much money that goes into the creation of a film on the front end. With very little guarantee of any money coming in on the back end.
Yeah.
And so I think my curiosity is always like, how do you get those first funds? You know, I think a lot of filmmakers, and maybe not the general public, but have read the Robert Rodriguez Rebel Without a Crew book, where he sold his body to science and was a lab rat to fund his first feature. But how did you guys manage getting that first project off the ground?
Well, it's interesting. We're kind of bookending because we didn't do it through Humanities Council grants, for example. Mm-hmm. We did get one small grant from Humanities Iowa for. To work on the script for the film, but they were I don't know, they were a little suspicious of our topic because it was the 1912 Villisca, Iowa axe murders.
Okay,
and so their assumption was that maybe, and I don't mean just them, but a lot of people thought, well, that's just some sort of sensational approach or whatever. But I mean, it's a sensational story, no question about it.
Yeah.
But we looked at that crime and its lingering effects. I mean, it was really a thorough examination of the way that a crime can distort a small community.
Sure.
So later, I think they were happy they supported it.
Yeah.
And then we had a terrific relationship with them. But like, the reason I say that now is because last spring, 2025, you know, the arts and humanities at the federal level, and then subsequently mostly at the state level too, has been eliminated. So we're kind of back where we started in a way.
Yeah, it's definitely
really tough.
A tough time for arts funding.
Yeah.
Well, and you have, you know, kind of looking through your website and all the things that you have produced, like you guys have done such a wide scope of different topics, you know, and as you said earlier, kind of focusing on Midwest stories.
Yeah.
When you're doing your research and prepping, like, is there something specific you look for in a story that, or just something that catches you about a certain story that you're like, I want to tell that story and dig into that?
Well, we make these choices together, Tammy and I, and it's fortunate that we have a similar aesthetic. You know, when it comes to making the film, we have similar interests. And so we don't have too many disagreements about that. Usually one or the other of us will say, well, what about this? And usually we're, you know, we're already on board.
Yeah.
But we do look for stories that have a local or regional following already, but are good enough stories that they deserve a wider awareness.
Sure.
And there's so many stories like that.
Yeah.
And we haven't focused particularly on the Quad Cities, more the Midwest region. Mm-hmm. I think we've had funding over the years from eight different humanities councils in the Midwest. But lately, more recently, we've been doing some Quad Cities stories, the Hero Street story, of course, an environmental film called Moved by Waters, which focused on water quality issues and people working on those issues here in the Quad Cities. So it's been nice to do some homegrown stuff too, for sure.
Well, yeah, let's kind of dive into the Hero Street, because I think that's how I first heard about you, was the Hero Street series. And you have one that just fairly recently came out, and you're in production for another one.
Yes.
I recently had David G. Smith, who's a local musician, and he had worked on one of the films and done the soundtrack for it, and we were talking about that. But tell us a little more. But it's such a fascinating story. You know, I didn't know about it before I moved out here, and it's really incredible.
It is. And the story is both unique to the Quad Cities, but it also represents similar stories that occurred throughout the Midwest.
Yeah.
But around the time of World War I, there was a manpower shortage in the U.S. because, the boys were in Europe.
Yeah.
And so railroad companies and other companies sent trains down into Mexico and recruited workers. And or workers were invited to make their own way, you know, to the States. And so that's what happened. And we ended up with three different barrios here in the Quad Cities. There was Holy City in Bettendorf. There was Cook's Point in Davenport. And then there was La Yarda or in Silvis.
Yeah. And
the folks in Silvis at the time didn't want Mexican workers living in town. Mm-hmm. And so the railroad supplied boxcar homes for the immigrants. And they had a small boxcar village right in the rail yard.
Yeah.
The folks there, one of the first things they did was they combined two boxcars and created a church, and they had a small community in the rail yard.
That's so, you know, we recently watched, my wife and I, the new Netflix version of Little House on the Prairie.
We did too.
Yeah, and it was beautifully shot.
Yeah,
Know, and I thought the casting was great, and, you know, kind of much more really dug in a little more, I thought, to like the hardship of that life.
Yes.
Rather than kind of I think a little more sanitized
made for TV
series from the 70s. Yeah. But that idea that is just so foreign to me as a, you know, late 20th century, early 21st century American of, hey, we saw a flyer. There's work 1,000 miles away. Let's just pack up our entire lives and go there, on a wing and a prayer.
Yep.
And these communities did that.
Well, they did, and part of the motivation was not just a job, but they were caught in the middle of the Mexican Revolution, and so it was a very, very dangerous time to be just alive in Mexico.
Yeah.
And so being in the yard meant you weren't hungry, which was another problem that was happening in Mexico with the war happening, with the revolution happening. You felt safe, and you had work, and you had your family. So there was a great deal of security to, a feeling of security to being in that boxcar village in the rail yard.
Right. And so as that community developed, that kind of led us to Hero Street and this very concentrated group of men who all served for the U.S. military and served in World War II and the Korean War and, you know, tragically lost their lives. But tell me a little more about the history of that. You know, it's so fascinating to me, like these people who immigrated here and then chose to turn around and serve this country that they worked for. And
Well, so around the time of the Great Depression, there was some resentment building in Silvis. They thought, well, the folks down there are not paying real estate taxes. They shouldn't be getting this free ride down in the rail yard. So the families moved up to 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Streets in Silvis. 2nd Street, now called Hero Street, was a former dump site. And in building homes on 2nd Street, if you could go up there now and peel back the siding on several of the homes, you would find boxcars underneath.
Wow.
So a number of homes were created from boxcars. Others were built, and that's how the families came to settle on 2nd Street.
Yeah.
So as time goes by, of course, the war comes along, and most of the young men living on the street who were of drafting age and age to enter the military had been born in America. So they were American citizens, and They were, like a lot of young men, they were eager to go, many of them. And
yeah.
Some signed up right away. Some waited until they were drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Some were married with children by the time they went off to war. And it's just it's a reflection, certainly, of their desire to be Americans and to support the nation. And it's also a twist of fate. You know, Tammy's from Waterloo, Iowa, where the Sullivan brothers are kind of well known. These mm-hmm. were brothers that were all killed on the same ship, you know.
Yeah.
And so it that kind of a story captures your attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's a much bigger story behind that that you learn about.
Right.
So that's the way this story unfolds. We do have these individual young men, and each of their families have a story. They have their own story. And then they join this larger narrative of World War II or the Korean War.
Yeah.
Where they were in some of the largest kind of events or military engagements that occurred, you know, during the war. Operation Market Garden, the Battle of the Bulge,
mm-hmm.
Anzio. Our man, Frank Sandoval, was in Burma working on the Lido Road, so in the jungle.
Yeah.
So these young men really went from, you know, growing up in Silvis to seeing the world. And
yeah.
But seeing in a way that you would prefer not to see it, you know, that it was difficult. They were in some bad situations.
Yeah.
And eight of them ultimately lost their lives. And what we're told is that this is more men lost from any street of any size in America.
Wow. It's just kind of mind-boggling when you think about that. And, you know, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, mm-hmm. but you have done episodes focusing on each
yep.
of these individual stories. And you just did The Last Fall.
Yes.
And you've got another one that you're in production for called A World Away From.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about those two particular stories.
Well,
what you can reveal.
Yeah, so the Last to Fall from Hero Street, that's actually the last episode. And maybe that's a place where I can say, well, people might ask, well, why are you doing these out of order?
Yeah.
And we have to approach the series from the standpoint of having the resources to tell a particular story.
Sure.
So it isn't just funding, which has been really extraordinarily difficult for this project, but it's photographs, it's letters,
yeah.
it's people to interview. And so we've worked on the stories as we have the greatest access to those elements.
Sure.
So, John Munoz, his story was told in The Last to Fall, and he fought in the Korean War, and he was indeed the last from Hero Street to come home. In his case, his body was not recovered, but his story led him to the Korean War, and it was interesting to work with that topic because I didn't know that much about the Korean War, and I think a lot of
yeah.
people don't.
Yeah.
And so it's those two episodes, the one for John Munoz and then for Joe Gomez, he's the other young man who died in the Korean War. We're going to learn about those young men, but also about the war that many of us don't know that much about.
Yeah.
It's a challenge to tell these stories because the people who knew the heroes directly and also even people who fought alongside them or even in the same war, you know, we've lost many, if not almost all of our World War II vets.
Yeah.
Now we're losing our Korean War vets. We've lost a lot of Vietnam vets. So we're always racing chasing the clock, I guess, to
right.
make sure that we can get these interviews done.
Well, and that, you know, it's so important, and you mentioned kind of the Korean War kind of gets lost in the
mm-hmm.
the larger narrative. And I remember a couple of the times I was working out in Los Angeles and thinking about seeing things about the Mexican-American War. And I was just like, you know, I picked up a book on it and was reading it. And I was like, man, I feel like we know nothing and no one ever talks about these conflicts.
Yeah.
And there, you know, there are some conflicts that have such a kind of greater presence in our cultural narrative, and others that were equally as important and devastating for individuals and families that for some reason we just don't talk about.
Yeah, I think there was a clarity that ended with World War II.
Sure.
About military engagements.
Yeah.
And the Korean War was a United Nations action.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was a different kind of a war and fought differently. And I think people just didn't understand. And this kind of, I think, snowballed with Vietnam, which was even more complex and confusing for people.
Right.
So it's unfortunate because I think the vets from the Korean War and the Vietnam War kind of get shortchanged in terms of acknowledgement, or they certainly did at the time they returned.
Yeah.
And I think it's good that we've tried to, you know, make up for that since.
Yeah. Well, and just, I mean, the way, not to get into warfare too much here, but warfare has evolved in such a different way where we're not just stacking up as many people as possible and bludgeoning each other. And, you know, I don't like any warfare, but
right.
technology has changed it.
Well, what I always think about with these young men is just how growing up myself in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And being able to visit the outside world, so to speak, or live elsewhere, it's eye-opening. But what they experienced is eye-opening in a whole different level. I mentioned Frank Sandoval, and you know he's working on the Lido Road, where you're basically a construction worker. Maybe you're driving heavy equipment or this kind of thing. But
right.
You're also, you know, dodging snipers, and there's a possibility you may be attacked by a tiger. I mean, this is a different world.
Yeah.
And for each of the young men, the eight young men, they were thrown into something that was a completely different world.
Yeah.
And there's some romantic ideas about war that you have as a young man.
Yeah.
That don't turn out to be that way once you're in the midst of it.
Yeah.
We have letters from young men who are in, and they're saying, "Well, I hope so and so doesn't get in. It's not what he thinks it is." And you know, they went through some tough times.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely war is bad.
There is. And there's a lot of pride. We the other day led a tour, a riverine tour for River Action in Silvis, and. It's exciting to share the story with people, and Brian Munoz, who's a great nephew of John Munoz, met us there and bore his testimony, and he's a veteran, and just a lot of civic pride, you know, comes out of that community, and so we want to tell these stories and celebrate that.
Yeah. Well, tell us where can we find Hero Street?
Well, the street itself, of course, you can find in Silvis. You don't even have to hardly enter the city before it's there.
Everybody
should go visit the street. The stories make so much difference, so much more sense when you can visit where they actually took place.
Yeah.
And the same is true with Hero Street. So watch our films. There are two good books written, Mark Wilson, Hero Street USA, and Carlos Harrison, The Ghosts of Hero Street. Those will give you some background for the story and our films, of course, and then go to the street and see where it all happened.
Yeah. You've also got another project you're working on, kind of shifting away from Hero Street, about the Peshtigo Fire in Wisconsin.
Yes.
I had never heard of this and was reading about it on your website last night and just kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, mine too when I first heard about it because I'm a Wisconsin native, small n.
Yeah.
And so it's been fun to do. Some of our stories have involved Wisconsin, the Barn Raisers Country School, One Room, One Nation, the Iowa story. So we've been in Wisconsin a little bit, but this is purely a Wisconsin story. And I stumbled across it on YouTube. I mean, I don't even remember how I found it. But it fit our interests perfectly because here's a great story that a lot of people don't know about. We've all heard of the Great Chicago Fire, though.
Yes.
I have to put great in quotes now, though, because the level of the tragedy was so much greater in Wisconsin. And it was all the product of a drought, mm-hmm. Extended drought, and a regional windstorm that occurred on that day. So you had the Chicago Fire, and you had the Peshtigo Fire. The Peshtigo Fire was 1.2 million acres burned.
Wow.
The city of Peshtigo was completely destroyed, and a dozen other communities were affected also, or again, partially destroyed or yeah. whatever. And then we had fires over also in Michigan. So there was a weird little rumor at the beginning of this whole thing that somehow this was all, these were fires set by a meteorite that came through the atmosphere and broke up and then set all these fires.
Oh, fascinating.
But the truth is, there were just a lot of smoldering fires in the region because yeah. there was a lot of, this was the timber industry that was happening up mm-hmm. in northern Wisconsin. And I mean, they were cutting everything they could cut yes. as fast as they could cut it.
Yes.
And burning the debris, and farmers were clearing fields. And so between the drought and the fire management
yeah.
and really an enormous wind event that occurred in the Midwest. It's what they call the Peshtigo paradigm.
Yeah.
Which is something that folks who fight fires learn about.
Yeah. Well, and it's so, you know, I think relevant, right? Like, we're seeing the effects of so many wildfires right now.
Yes.
From the fires out west and the fires up in Canada. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I love about documentaries, and my wife and I watch documentaries all the time. You know, just being able to, you know, we learn from our history.
Right.
And we see these things and see that, you know, it's very easy to watch a 2-minute highlight on the news of a fire and say, oh my gosh, that's so awful.
Yeah.
But to be able to get a deeper dive into yeah. those effects, and like you were talking about with your that first piece about the 1912 axe murderers, the long-standing effects on a community.
Yep.
You know, it's not just, incidents like this are not just isolated incidents that happen and then they go
right.
away. Like, people are changed and towns are changed by these things.
Absolutely. And of course, you have nothing can bring more change than completely being destroyed, which is what happened with the city of Peshtigo.
Right.
And when you visit there today, I should mention that they lost 1,500 to 2,000 people. They don't even really know.
Sure.
Because people, animals were completely incinerated in some cases.
Yeah.
In some cases they were found, they looked like they were untouched but deceased. So we don't have an actual accurate count. But it was a tremendous loss of life. And then, but if you visit there today, as you're driving into the city of Peshtigo, there's a city sign on the city limits, and around the letters of Peshtigo, there are flames licking up from underneath. And when we first saw that, maybe coming from the Villisca tragedy perspective, it was like,
yeah.
What's that all about?
Right.
It seemed a little sensational.
Mm-hmm.
But the community has this back from the ashes pride, and that's their expression of it.
Yeah.
And they have a wonderful museum in town there that tells the story. And the story is, as always with these, it's the human story.
Right.
So we have accounts from people who survived the fire. And one of the unique things about the Peshtigo fire, it's very similar to what happened in Pacific Palisades just recently.
Yeah.
There was a fire in Maui where it was this wind, drought, and so on. So all of those elements were the same, but Peshtigo survivors, some described a fire storm, a tornado made of fire.
Oh, wow.
So you often hear this expression when people are talking about fires, that they create their own weather.
Yeah.
And that was what happened with the Peshtigo fire, with the size, the magnitude, the temperatures of that conflagration. It was just devastating. And so we have the stories of people who survived, and those are also pretty devastating.
Yeah.
And amazing. And of course, then people died later, too, just from having been injured or
sure.
smoke inhalation and all kinds of things. But it was a tremendous tragedy that we don't know about.
Yeah.
Because of the way things were covered in the media at the time. The focus was on Chicago. And there was also a communications issue, because even the governor of the state of Wisconsin didn't know about the Peshtigo fire until several days later. He was involved with sending aid to Chicago. They were sending trains of aid to Chicago. So, interestingly, when word came, it was his young wife. He was a Civil War veteran, and his young wife is the one who received the news, and she immediately turned one of those trains north, and she's the person who started the aid work to try to help the folks in the in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's. I can't wait to see it. And you're in production now. It's coming out next year in 2017.
Yep. We're going to show. We're going to kind of preview a short version in Peshtigo, actually in nearby Marinette.
Okay.
This fall, and we're still raising funds, and so we're hoping people seeing a little bit of what we're doing is going to help.
Yeah.
Gain some momentum on the funding side.
Yeah. Well. Kind of coming back to that, we kind of started with it.
Yeah.
Like, how can people support?
Well, we just did an online fundraiser for the Hero Street project through our website, and that went really well. It's a crazy time to try to raise money, and we found that that's actually a good time to raise money.
Right.
So that works. Our fiscal sponsor is Truth First Film Alliance here in the Quad Cities. That's a nonprofit, so people can give funds to the nonprofit. We're always looking for leads, so maybe there's a grant we don't know about, and you could tell us. Or maybe there's a foundation that would be interested that we don't know about.
Yeah,
that is really the frustrating part about funding, is I guess finding those partners who are interested in what you're doing, and willing and able to support, but maybe you just never find out who they are.
Right.
And so it's really a challenge.
Well, yeah, sometimes, I hear filmmakers talk about we had an angel investor who gave us X amount of dollars, and it's like, how did you find that person?
Yeah, no, that's right. And a lot of the folks that have supported us over the years are people we know, people have known us for a long time, but there's a mixture of things. We have a supporter that lives in Pacific Palisades, and on the day that the fire happened, this is someone who annually contributes to our work, and on the day the fire happened, I was writing a request, and then I started seeing these news reports, and it just was so weird. And then the way that things developed, the fire just kept getting worse and worse and worse. These are folks that have two homes up there. They have a son that has a home up there, and both of their homes were spared.
Yeah.
One received some damage, but it's always this way. All these things around us are connected.
Yeah.
And here we are talking about something that happened in October of 1871. And I'm writing to someone who's about to experience the same scenario in their community.
Yeah.
So that's the unfortunate part about history. When you get involved in examining it and telling those stories, all these things sound familiar.
Right.
And sometimes you feel like we've progressed much more than we actually have. Like, we are progressing, but wow, it's just going so much slower than it should.
Well, and that old trope of there are only really seven basic stories in the world that we're all building off of, but just that cycle of humanity and human existence, and that's the thing that I find so important about the arts in general is, whether it's documentary filmmaking or a painting, is it touches all of us on that very human level and allows us to connect, even if we have completely different backgrounds and completely different outlooks of life. We can watch a story like the Hero Street stories or the Peshtigo story and both connect with that in a way that makes us realize our shared humanity.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's why all of these films are about a certain thing, whatever mm-hmm. the topic is. We made this film called The Barn Raisers, so it was about vintage barns.
Yeah.
And the sort of mysterious people who built them. But that's really what it is about. It's about the people. It's about the people who built the barns. It's about the people who used the barns. It's about people now who are restoring them. Mm-hmm. It's always about people and about those human stories.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be Latino to connect to the Hero Street story.
Yeah.
For that very reason. These are human stories.
Well, and that's you have some Missouri roots, right?
Tammy and I went to school at Park University, so in the Kansas City area, and we lived there while we were in school.
I used to work at this theater in Missouri called the Arrow Rock Lyceum Theater, which is literally a town of 56 people.
Oh, wow.
They have this 400-seat theater, and they pack it every night.
Yeah.
People come from miles around, but there were the most gorgeous barns out there. And I always used to love going out there and, like, on our day off or whatever, would just go around and photograph these incredible barns. Mm-hmm. You know, so when I saw that on your website, I was like, oh, I've got to watch the barn one.
Well, I grew up exploring my grandfather's barn, and so that was a real personal story for me, just to be back in that environment. I come from a long line of farming people mm-hmm. since they hit the ground, basically, in America. So it was cool to reconnect with all of that and to help preserve and tell that amazing story.
Yeah, and how great, you know, I think some of what is implied in that, the Hero Street stories, is that idea and the promise of America, of the American dream, and, you know, coming from farmers and you're a filmmaker. You know, that's...
Well, it's farmer, barber, filmmaker. So, yeah, that is pretty cool. And also, thinking about Peshtigo, I do a little genealogy stuff when I have some spare time because it's fun.
Yeah.
And I have an ancestor who, last name was Calkins, and his father was born in Nova Scotia. He was born in Nova Scotia. And then the father moved the family into Maine, and then this young man became involved in the shipbuilding business, and he was a carpenter. And then somehow, and I don't know the reasons, but the family then made the move to northern Wisconsin, where he was a guy who would go into a forest and would estimate the value of the forest. So he was involved in the logging industry there. But this was something I just learned, you know, about my own family, that, I have people in the logging industry, and now we're telling this Peshtigo fire. So it helps me better understand my own family story by doing these things.
Well, and that's just an interesting personal time. The Goujon side of the family were up in like the Montreal area, mm-hmm. and they were involved in shipbuilding and the Coast Guard and all fur trading originally, and kind of migrated up the Great Lakes and settled in Michigan.
Yeah.
You know, so those shared histories that, you know, we all have that story somewhere.
Right.
So.
Well, that's right. And when we told the story of country schools, everybody, I don't care who you are, you have a country school in your family history.
Right.
You may not know it, but you do. And that's another film that was, I thought, well, it's about country schools, the buildings. And it's as much about those multitasking one-room school teachers who taught 8 grades in one room.
Yeah.
They were amazing.
I know. We're watching Little House on the Prairie again. We're thinking about that and just like,
yes.
Oh, my gosh.
So I shouldn't bring this up, but 2 of my relatives were in Laura Ingalls Wilder's classroom in DeSmit, South Dakota.
Oh, wow. How cool. See, we're all tied together.
So it seems.
Yeah. So, well, thank you so much for telling these stories. I mean, you guys have been so celebrated for your work, and very deservedly so. And it's such a, I think, a testament to the work you do, and that, you know, you're able to do that out of the Quad Cities. It's just really inspiring. And you know, we talked earlier about how people can support, but they can check out your work at fourthwallfilms.com.
Yes.
Right? And a lot of your stuff is on the local PBS stations.
It's on PBS. It's available on still on physical media, DVD, Blu-ray. We stream online now, of course, and we have digital downloads, so we have the waterfront covered. And it's been a joy to be here in the Quad Cities and to have the support that we do have to do the work. It makes a huge difference to have your community behind you and supportive. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all the work you do, Kelly. So nice to finally get to talk to you.
Nice to talk
to
you.
And I look forward to seeing the next installment of Hero Street and also the Peshtigo documentary. So anything else you got? Anything coming up other than those things that you want to let the world know about?
Not that I know of. I think we've completed, 24 films. One of those is a docudrama. And I think before we stop working, we will have done something over 30, I would guess. That's the way it's looking. So we're just pleased to be able to do that work and to tell those stories and to be here doing it.
Well, keep it up. Thank you so much for being here today. Thanks again to our sponsors, Quad City Bank and Trust, and also to my producer extraordinaire, man on the mix, Mr. Josh Graves. To learn more about Fourth Wall Films, visit www.fourthwallfilms.com. I'm Ben Goujon, and this was Talking Art.